Hello and welcome to another competitive episode of Saved by the 90s. My name is Adam Patterson. With me today, we got a guy who has a full collection of both the 1994 Topps and Upper Deck baseball cards. Ken Bakley. Hey, Ken.
Hello. I don't.
Just took the wind out of my sails right there.
I just like to make sure that the people understand that my life is not that interesting, especially in comparison to how I'm introduced every month.
Well, this month, we're going to be taking a look at baseball movies with four very different titles that all celebrate America's favorite pastime. So grab a hot dog and some Cracker Jacks, because this is Saved by the 90s.
It is more than just a game. It is a game of wins and losses, imperishable hope, and coming home. Baseball, it's the game of our lives. Available wherever video is sold.
Did that ad copy say that it's not just a game, it's a game of wins and losses?
I think so. That was for, I don't know if you could tell, but that was for Ken Burns baseball.
I could believe that. Yeah, that makes sense. I was trying to figure out what that was for, and I just couldn't get over that line. It's a game of wins and losses as opposed to other games, which I guess aren't.
A game of no winners and losers. A game.
Yeah.
A game of just nothing.
Yes, it's I guess the difference between a game that has winners and losses and a game that's just people standing motionless, staring at each other, doing nothing.
Imagining like a field of people just scattered around, just standing completely still.
Now this is a different kind of game than that baseball. First up to bat is a baseball comedy directed by the one and only Penny Marshall that explores the women's league that grew out of World War II. Released on July 1st, 1992, this is A League of Their Own.
This summer, Tom Hanks is managing the Rockford Peaches.
Are you crying? There's no crying in baseball!
Or are they managing him?
Let's get something started!
Oh, now, hey, on the field.
Tom Hanks, Gina Davis, Madonna. A League of Their Own, directed by Penny Marshall, rated PG.
Hey, who's the manager? I am!
Special sneak preview Saturday at select theaters.
What a rambunctious trailer that was.
Oh, I have a couple things to say about that trailer.
let me just give the synopsis here real quick. Two sisters join the first female professional baseball league and struggle to help it succeed amidst their own growing rivalry. Ken, we'll start with you.
The thing about that trailer, and the thing about how a lot of this movie's entered like the cultural lexicon, is that if you had just kind of gone off what people assume about it, and what I had just kind of subconsciously taken in about it, just not really being very familiar with it, you would assume that it is a substantially different movie in intent and tone and approach and content than what it actually is. Not to say that this is like a fundamentally very, you know, a movie that is just completely not about what you think it's about. But if you go kind of on the popular assumption of it, you assume it's a movie about different people that goes about it in a completely different way.
Yeah. So the backstory with this is that Penny Marshall in 1986 watched a documentary about this women's league that, if you're not familiar, during World War II, there weren't that many people over here to play baseball. So the Major League Baseball season was canceled, and I don't know who it was in real life got the idea to create this women's league, but in the movie, someone, like a chocolatier, his name's Harvey, he decided to create a women's league to take place of the men's league. And so that's essentially what this movie's about. But, you know, I don't know how to feel about this movie, honestly. Like, I really liked it as a kid, but to just give you a little bit more backstory about me, I used to be obsessed with baseball when I was a kid. I loved everything baseball. So if it was baseball, even if it was a crappy movie, I was still into it. And I think that I appreciate what this movie is going for. I think that it's good that this story gets told, because I think that without this movie, I think a lot of people, myself included, wouldn't even be familiar with this. So I think that it has a lot going for it, but at the same time, I feel like the script is so poorly written and everything is so overly sentimental, and it's so sappy, and a lot of it I just can't take very seriously. And I also feel like it undercuts itself a lot too.
It's in a really major way a story about a direction and a cast overcoming all of the material's worst instincts.
Yeah. Yeah, because you have a really great cast here. I mean, what an ensemble. This is a phenomenal cast. Everybody's just firing on all cylinders. You have Gina Davis in the lead role. You got Tom Hanks in there in a great role as Jimmy Dugan.
He's very good in this. And also, but just to pause for a second, that's kind of one of the points that I was trying to come around to, is that, if you kind of go on what this movie seems to be promoted as based on the trailer, or how people have talked about it, you would assume this is that Tom Hanks is like the main character in it. Like that this was a movie about women's baseball league and the main character is Tom Hanks.
Yeah. The trailer makes it out to be like a Bad News Bears type thing where, you know, Tom Hanks is in charge of putting together this scrappy team and making it work, but that's not really how it plays out.
No, and at its core, like, it'd be interesting to see, because this seems to be one of those movies where the story credit and the screenplay credit go to different people, to different teams of writers. It'd be interesting to imagine, kind of, or to actually know, to put it better, what that journey is, because the more I think about it, and it really does feel like a bunch of different movies.
So I think I do know a little bit of insight into this. Kim Wilson and Kelly Candaly, those are the two women who did the documentary. So they were actually brought on as consultants when Penny Marshall decided to create a movie out of this. So she paired them up with Lowell Gantz, who was the main screenwriter. There's another screenwriter that's listed here as well, Babalu Mandel.
Yeah, he had a lot of he was doing a lot of stuff around this time, wasn't he?
Yeah, and so I think that she paired the two of them up with these guys when they were working on adapting or creating the script for, I guess, maybe more like historical accuracy, I think, is what they were going for. The weird thing about this script, though, is that it feels like it was written by someone who is not familiar with baseball at all. Like, there's like basic terminology that they don't quite get right a lot, and it just doesn't feel super accurate. Not that it has to or anything. I mean, the main story's there, and I actually don't know a whole lot about the real story behind this, so I can't really speak to how accurate it is on that front either.
The very minimal information I can give you from the 20 seconds of research that I can recall from memory at the moment is that I believe the Harvey Chocolatier character was based on Philip K. Wrigley of the Wrigley chewing gum guy company, who actually was a baseball executive who was very much instrumental to founding, or maybe just did found the real life league.
And I know that this was at least partially shot at Wrigley Field. The tryout scene was at Wrigley Field. So yeah, I don't know. I guess revisiting it after all these years, I still had fun with it during the baseball scenes. Like, I thought that those were very entertaining, and I thought that, again, just to reiterate the cast, I thought everybody was awesome. Like, Rosie O'Donnell was so funny in this, and Madonna was great. Lori Petty plays the younger sister of Gina Davis's character, and that's where that whole kind of rivalry thing plays into it, which is not very well developed, in my opinion. No. Like, I don't... The rivalry, like, it's there, but it's, like, doesn't feel very real to me. Like, I never quite understood, like, what the big deal was between the two of them. And then at the end, so, you know, you have this where they play, and I don't know how many seasons it ended up being. Not that many. But... Yeah, you have this scene at the end. Well, it's sort of bookended, really, of like modern day, and there's like a reunion thing that they do. And I guess that they opened up an exhibit at the Baseball Hall of Fame for them. I don't know if that's real or not. I don't think it is, actually, which makes it even more depressing. But that whole scene where they're like doing the reunion thing and singing the song, like, I just like, this is too much, man. This is so. It just goes so overboard with like the sappiness, and I had a really hard time with that. Although it's kind of
a very jumbled and not,
and it's
very
so long
script.
Too.
Yeah,
like that whole like epilogue is just so long. I will give them credit for finding an amazing set of older actors who bear a very striking resemblance to their younger selves.
Was very well done.
Although they did a weird thing. They didn't do it with everybody. They only did it with Gina Davis's character, where they dubbed the actor who played older Gina Davis, and they dubbed her with actual Gina Davis, which was bizarre. And I wish they didn't do that. Like, I didn't, you know, like you're not fooling anybody, you know what I mean? Like, the audience knows that Gina Davis hasn't aged like 50 years, so you can just have it be the other actor.
They harnessed time travel to film the scene with like Gina Boyhood. Davis in 2042, and then brought it back to put it in at the end of this movie.
They actually waited 30 years to complete the movie because they wanted it to be like Boyhood and accurately age everyone for that one scene.
The power of time travel, a league of their own epilogue was filmed in real time.
I remember that this movie was not very well received when it first came out. And, you know, revisiting it now, I can kind of see why. Like pro independent woman like ideology that it seems to have, I feel like there's always going to be one other scene that's followed up by them sort of backpedaling on that idea.
Yeah, this is very much like the movie that is written, the movie that is like completed and approved and released is still very much of like a 1992 like male dominated Hollywood establishment's idea of what like a movie with feminist messaging is.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know how to like fully articulate it, but it almost feels like it's sort of like a look at that, women can do it too, you know, like a, like almost like a, there's like a, almost a condescending
yeah aura I was gonna about say it.
And it feels off. But I don't know.
Yeah.
I gotta say this is definitely one that I kind of regret revisiting because I just did not find myself enjoying it as much as I did when I was a kid. I guess I just didn't see all of its many flaws.
I think it's a movie that has a lot of problems that isn't really as like strong and enduring as this cast and this subject matter would imply that this movie could be. I'd say that I did just enjoy watching it just for what it is, because it is like a really just great cast that's working really well together and working often in spite of the material that they have. So I just enjoyed watching it. I also don't really have a history with it where I have like really well-guarded nostalgia for it. So I think my expectations were maybe somewhere in a different place. But for what it is, I thought it was pretty well done.
I would like to say, like, just to reiterate, I think that the performances in this alone are enough to make it something of a... I don't want to say classic, but I can see why this movie has sort of stood the test of time. I mean, it's still in the, like, people still talk about this movie. It's still, you know, you see clips of it and stuff, like the no crying in baseball scene and all of that stuff. And, like, Tom Hanks was, like, just so incredible in this movie. The cast, I think, was enough to elevate it, you know, beyond its sort of shortcomings. And again, I will say that I really enjoyed all of the baseball scenes. I thought that that was really fun, and I just like the overall setting, just the Americana of it. I like any movies that sort of exude Americana. So I definitely liked the style of this as well. I did want to mention they are remaking this. It's going to be a TV show. I'm not sure if you've heard
of that. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's going to be a TV show that Abby Jacobson is starring in. And I think she's working on developing the show as well. It's going to be an Amazon show. So I think they're filming it now, maybe.
Yeah. I think there was something just when I was kind of looking around for information about it. I think Jamie Babbitt, did the pilot, but
yeah, I think that'll probably be out. I don't know if this year, if it'll be out anymore this year, probably next year, but I know they're filming it because I saw something about Rosie O'Donnell being in it as well. She just has a cameo, I think. Yeah, so I think that's cool. I think Abby Jacobson is going to do a really good job with this, so I'm very excited to see this being remade. Should be pretty fun.
Yeah.
Next on the plate is a live-action Disney film released in what I think of as the heyday of kids' movies. Directed by William Dear and hitting theaters on July 15th, 1994, this is Angels in the Outfield.
From Walt Disney Pictures, they were a team headed in the wrong direction.
Boy, they're bad.
Until a young fan wished for a miracle.
Maybe you could help them win a little.
And got an angel.
Holy cow!
No one can see me or hear me but you.
Here we go again.
You really do see something.
This summer,
Rattable!
There's magic in the air and angels in the outfield. Rated PG. Starts Wednesday, July 13th at a theater near you.
When a boy prays for a chance to have a family, if the California Angels win the pennant, angels are assigned to make that possible. So, Adam, start us off by telling us a little bit about your history with this movie, because when I was pitching this episode to you, you seemed to kind of stay on that one a little bit.
Yeah, I saw this in the theater with my cousin, actually. My cousin was a huge baseball fan, too, and he would come up and visit every summer, and we would play baseball, watch baseball, do everything baseball for a time. And I absolutely loved this movie. It came out when I was 10 years old, and it just, man, I loved me some Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Little Levitt. Mm-hmm. Big Christopher Lloyd fan, because I really loved the Back to the Future movies. And this movie was great. As a kid, when I was a child,
yeah,
I will underscore that. When I was a child, this movie was great. Now, we revisited this movie not too long ago. We were guests on another podcast, and we talked about 90s kids sports movies. So we talked about a whole bunch of these, including like The Sandlot and stuff like that. And this was one of them, and so it was pretty fresh in my mind already, but I did rewatch it for this, just to make sure I didn't miss anything. And so my sentiments back then, what was that, like a year ago or something that we were on that other podcast?
2 years ago. That was a couple of years
was
ago.
Was it? Yeah. Well, time. Time is just so, anyway. I feel the same way as I did when we were on that show. I think that this is a really bizarre movie that,
yes,
I'm not sure how it exists or why it exists. And if you think about this movie for like even just half a minute, you're just like, what is going on here? Like, these angels are helping a baseball team that sucks. They're helping them cheat their way to win the pennant. Like, that's literally what they're doing. They're just helping a team cheat. And
yeah,
there's not many lessons to be learned here. You know, like a lot of these live action Disney movies have like a moral and stuff, and they're all pretty like altruistic in the end, but there's not really a whole lot of that going on here. Now, like in the final game, the angels are like, oh, you have to win the championship on your own. Like, we'll help you cheat your way to the championship, but then you're on your own after that. And so, but it's like, we didn't learn anything. None of these players learned anything. Like, Danny Glover maybe learned to not be a mean, I guess. Like, it just, it's such a weird movie. And watching it now as an adult, it just doesn't work for me at all.
If this movie was 20% more coherent, it would be a staple on all those lists of like movies that you watched as a kid that actually have terrible lessons in them.
Yeah.
If it actually had a lesson in it.
Yeah. I mean,
it's really close to having one, and it's really close to having a really bad one.
Well, the whole thing is, so if we step back and we look at why the angels come down, like the synopsis says, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, he's living in a temporary foster home, and his dad, played by Dermot Mulroney, is like a complete deadbeat guy. And in like he says in passing, so he comes to visit him one day, and in passing he's like, yeah, I'll take you back when the angels win the pennant or whatever. And then that's what causes him to wish for the angels to win the pennant. I don't know why they don't go all the way and just want them to wish, you know, win the whole World Series, but whatever.
Is it because of a trademark reason?
I don't know, actually. But either way, that's what makes the angels come down. And it's like, of all the things, why don't the angels know right off the bat, like, this guy should not be with this child? He's clearly not fit, an unfit parent. Now, maybe they knew all along. They're playing the long game, and they knew that if they introduced this kid and his friend JP to Danny Glover, that Danny Glover would eventually bring them in as foster kids. So that's possible. But if they didn't know that, then they were doing a very bad thing. Potentially dangerous. Potentially harmful to this child.
Yeah. And now I'm thinking about it. You've really gotten me stuck on why won't they just say the World Series? Because they can use, obviously, like, real team names. It's not like, what is going on there?
I don't know. I really don't
know. I don't know. I don't know why I'm fixated on this. I guess you could...
Maybe they lost, because I don't know what point in the season this starts, the Angels start. So maybe it's a situation where they lost so many games that it wouldn't be possible for them. But I don't know.
Yeah, maybe they could. Maybe they didn't have the World Series because they could see the future, and 1994 was the year without a World Series.
So you have a pretty surprising cast here. I already mentioned Joseph Gordon-Levitt as the main character. You have Danny Glover in there as well, Christopher Lloyd. You have Tony Danza as Mel Clark. Now, in every baseball movie, you have to have one veteran on the team who used to be like a superstar, but is now like on the verge of retirement. You know, he's in his last year. Every baseball movie has this. And he fits that role.
Talk about a whole movie about that guy.
We're gonna just stay tuned.
Yeah.
Neil McDonough's in here as this like goofball character, which is kind of funny because you don't really see him in that role ever. So that's kind of surprising. You have Adrian Brody in a early role for him. Matthew McConaughey in an early role for him. So it's
fascinating cast.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting cast. And then, of course, you have Taylor Negron, who I think was in like every 90s kids movie back then. So, yeah, interesting cast. Not a lot of not a lot going on with any of them particularly. I mean, they were all just kind of goofballs. I mean, the whole joke was that the Angels sucked and like they were like screw ups, I guess, and until the Angels helped them cheat and win.
In terms of movies with cohesive good energy, this is the anti A League of Their Own.
Yeah, I mean, it's like
this has incohesive bad energy.
It's like Disney was like, hey, we want to do like a sort of a kid's version of Major League. And so the team has like Major League vibes where they're all kind of like goofball screw ups.
This is a remake of another movie from 1951 that I know I had seen, but I can't remember anything about.
Yeah, it's the 51 version. It had the same title. It was with the Pittsburgh. It was with the Pirates. And I think it was a similar idea, but it wasn't the same exact concept, I don't think. Now, they also made Angels in the End Zone, which came out after this, and that was a straight to video release. But Christopher Lloyd came back for that one, and that starred it wasn't Joey Lawrence, but his younger brother. I can't remember his name. It was a Lawrence. The younger Lawrence from Mrs. Doubtfire. I did not see Angels in the End Zone. I could not bring myself to watch that.
Matthew Lawrence is the name.
Matthew Lawrence, that's it. And I also don't know if Angels in the End Zone is like available anywhere. So.
And then there's the third one.
That's the third one?
No, that was the second one. And now we're talking, no. There's Angels in the Outfield, Angels in the End Zone, the second one, and then Angels in the Infield.
Oh, Angels in the Infield.
It aired on ABC. It was a TV movie on ABC.
There it is.
Aired in 2000.
Angels in the Infield. Oh, it was a Wonderful World of Disney one. That's what it is. Okay. Interesting. A group of angels try to help a baseball team win a championship game while at the same time helping to reunite the team's pitcher's family. Wait, who's in this? Patrick Warburton and David Alan Grier. David Alan Grier plays the angel. Wow. I mean, that looks better than Angels in the End Zone, to be honest.
Hmm.
Well, at any rate, I will never watch any of the sequels because, frankly, I don't want to watch the original one ever again after this.
You know.
I've watched Angels in the Outfield twice in the last 2 years, apparently, so I'm good forever on that.
It's one of those things, I guess, that you shouldn't revisit.
You got to believe. Sometimes you
just gotta let your memories be good memories. You can't go home again.
I just like the poster with the tagline. You gotta believe, and then at the bottom it just says it could happen. Yeah, it could happen. It's possible.
Good. Also, I'm now realizing to show how much I actually know about baseball history, my World Series joke doesn't even work because I didn't actually know the actual nature of the baseball strike. Besides there not being World Series, there were no playoffs either, so there was no pennant.
Oh really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Huh. Interesting. Well, at any rate, yeah, I didn't enjoy it. Did you like this? I feel like I didn't.
No,
I just kind of like hogged the whole conversation about this movie.
Well, it's good that you did, because as you were talking and had all of these specific anecdotes and observations, I was thinking, do I have anything to say about this movie? Do I have anything to add besides it has bad vibes? The answer is no.
It definitely does have bad vibes.
This was the first movie I watched for this podcast. I rewatched it a week ago and it's just gone. Just, I remember like 10 things that happened in it.
I did like that there were a couple 90s isms in this. There was this one older kid that they lived with. His name was Miguel, and he was rocking a No Fear t-shirt in one scene. So I was like, all right, No Fear. There it is. Which I don't even know if that's still around, but man, No Fear hats and shirts were just like really big back then. There was a sign that had the Incredible Crash Test Dummies on it, which was a thing for a minute there. Which is so odd when you think about it. And maybe this is actually something that we should talk about on a later episode, is the fact that the crash test dummies were turned into like a media property where there was like a cartoon and toys and stuff like that. Crash test dummies. Like for cars, like that was actually turned into a thing.
There's, I hate that I immediately went into like, I don't know, like thesis, like book pitch brain, but there's like some whole like exhausting like metaphor reading for what that would say when the crash test dummies and cars become cultural figures, what that's actually conveying.
Yeah, it's really weird.
Yeah, it feels like some kind of it feels like you could use it as the starting point for like analyzing some like collective societal breakdown.
Somebody needs to do yeah. something about
somebody needs that. To do a thesis about this.
Yeah.
Trade you a Paul Molitor for a Tony Gwynn.
Okay.
What? I'm worth two Molitors.
No way. This guy's been out in the sun too long.
Check out the stats. 329 lifetime batting average and 4 batting titles.
I was breaking World Series records when he was still a rookie.
Official Major League Baseball cards from Donruss, Fleer, Score, and Upper Deck make all your favorite players come alive.
You want a fair trade? Me for two of him and a Jim Abbott.
Hey, I resent that.
Our third inning film this month is a baseball-themed thriller from director Tony Scott. Released on August 16th, 1996, this is The Fan.
Imagine someone so devoted to you.
Go, Bobby!
You're everything he lives for.
Bobby, I'm watching you.
And the one thing he'd kill for. The Fan.
An all-star baseball player becomes the unhealthy focus of a down-on-his-luck salesman. Now, this is a movie that I saw in the theater. My uncle actually took me to see this movie. Because my uncle, he's the one who got me into baseball as a kid. He's like a baseball fanatic. And took me to go see it. And we were both big fans of this movie. And the weird thing about this is the end of this movie. And maybe I'm jumping ahead and we can circle back. But I
love to talk about here.
I don't remember it ending the way it does, which is crazy to me that I have this like false memory of how the movie The Fan ended. Like, I swear, like in my memory, I thought it ended on the beach, and it doesn't. Like, it's weird. It's very bizarre.
But there are scenes on the beach in it, so
there are.
Yeah.
But like, I have this weird memory of Robert De Niro and Wesley Snipes having a confrontation, like a final confrontation sort of on the beach. And that's not what happens. So I didn't remember the actual ending. Like, it wasn't familiar to me as I was watching it.
Yeah. I mean, this is a pretty bonkers movie.
Yeah.
And the ending by any standard is pretty bonkers, but oddly by the standard of this movie, not the strangest choice that it's made in it.
No, it is a bonkers movie, and I appreciate it. And I really, you know, watching this after all these years, it just made me think, like, I really miss Tony Scott, and I wish he was still around making these kinds of movies, because I really like Tony Scott movies. And
I know everybody says it, but we need these kinds of movies now more than ever.
We do. We really do. I still like The Fan a lot, even though I see the flaws with it. It's bloated, it's messy, a lot of it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. De Niro's character feels fake. Like, he doesn't even feel like it. Feels like this sort of weird amalgamation of like Travis Bickle character and his Cape Fear character, and it just, I don't know, doesn't really mesh well, although De Niro obviously does an incredible job in the role. There's a lot of Nine Inch Nails in this. That,
I was about to say, the soundtrack is like Rolling Stones and Nine Inch Nails alternating cues.
It's a really weird choice for the soundtrack. So you have you know, the character, this main character, this fan, Gil, who loves the Rolling Stones and apparently worked with them at some point. Like, he keeps having these offhanded conversations about how he worked with them, although they never really explore that at all. Like, nobody calls him out on it or anything, unless I missed that conversation. But he's like obsessed with the Rolling Stones, but then throughout the whole movie, you have Nine Inch Nails playing. So you have like these really weird scenes where it's like, I want to F you like an animal. And it's just like, it doesn't necessarily fit. Although it fits within the context of a 90s thriller where everybody's trying to go for that like industrial hard rock vibe. So in that regard, I think it kind of does work. But at the same time, the Gil character is not like like Kevin Spacey's character in Seven or something like that, where he's just this like kind of sadistic, grimy killer, you know?
No.
And he has like a creepy home base or whatever, but you don't really see, you see part of it at the beginning, I believe. And then you see it at the end, but you don't really know how like imbalanced he is until the very, very end. I don't know. I still enjoyed it. I think it's a solid thriller. I think it's too long. I think there's way too much bloat to it. Too many side stories and things. Wesley Snipes is a treasure. I want to see him in more stuff. That's pretty much all I have about it.
Benicio del Toro is in this, and his character. To that Nine Inch Nails cue, and just like a scene that goes on that actually isn't that long, but when you're watching it feels like it's like 45 minutes long.
I will say that scene was pretty brutal. Like, I forgot about that too. Oh, yeah. And that scene's pretty brutal when he gets stabbed in the leg.
Mm-hmm.
He barely has any lines in this movie at all. No. So, which is weird. Like, he's in it. He's in it a good bit. But he just doesn't have it. Like, but he doesn't talk.
Mm-hmm.
It's very bizarre. Not sure what that's all about. John Leguizamo's in here. He's Wesley Snipes' manager, Manny. Good role for him. Ellen Barkin is in here as this sports journalist. Mm-hmm. In a role that is completely unnecessary. Like, she's good in it, but I would argue that the role itself is completely unnecessary. Like, I think that she just existed to sort of try to pad out these characters a little bit and give us some backstory as far as, like, the drama behind Wesley Snipes' character and stuff like that. And to have Gil be able to, like, call in and so we can see, like, the level of his fanaticism. But I would also say that, like, the Barkin character was just not really needed for the movie.
No, the big problem with this movie, and there are problems, but like you, there's just, I agree that there's just so much going on in here, and it's just so wild that I can't help but just be fascinated by it. The characterization, you have literally any character in this movie, including even the main characters, is just, everyone's treated like a third tier supporting character, basically, in terms of how well thought out they are. Interesting cast for some reason. One of the few things that I probably will always remember about this movie, if I forget nothing else, would be obviously the music, and secondly that Dan Butler's in this as Robert De Niro's boss, the head of the knife company, Bulldog from Frasier. This is who I know him as, of course.
Yep, Bulldog from Frasier. Oh my god, I forgot about that character.
And again, like, in that interesting thing of a sitcom character who was just like there, maybe not there a lot, but like always there for at least a couple minutes.
Mm-hmm. I love at the end where it gets so bonkers at the end. It just goes so off the rails when he is somehow able to kidnap Wesley Snipes' son, steal his car, take the kid to like his buddy's place, kill his buddy, then take the kid, stash him somewhere, go to the game, call Wesley Snipes, tell him he's got to hit a home run. Then he somehow infiltrates the stadium and then dresses up as an umpire and takes the role of the umpire of the game and is able to confront Wesley Snipes on the field during the game. It's wild.
He knows what he wants to do and he does it.
Yeah, it's just, it takes a lot of leaps of faith, I think. But at the same time, it's still kind of charming. This is another movie that was not well received. I don't think a lot of people were really into this one. And
yeah, I feel like even the strange charms of this movie that feel so apparent to us, I feel like would definitely be completely lost on like the American critical mainstream of 1996.
Yeah, and I think probably you could probably say the same thing about people who are revisiting or exploring this movie from a critical standpoint, like now. It's still not a very polished movie. Oh, no. It's very plodding, and the whole like the relationship with his son and the ex-wife and all of that stuff doesn't really go anywhere, and it's just a lot of these pieces that just don't really seem to matter in the end. Like, it's a guy who seems to be cracking, and the character makes these decisions and stuff, and but it's just like, is that really justified? Like, did enough happen to him to really make him crack like this? Like, he's a like 50-year-old guy. Like, what was the event that all of a sudden made him completely lose it? Is it because Wesley Snipes said that the fans aren't important? You know, like, it's just, there wasn't enough there to really justify his actions. I didn't feel
that's kind of what the movie accidentally makes it be at the end, isn't it?
Yeah,
just like one throwaway sentiment.
You get, well, yeah. So,
well, truly, well, obviously, from the start, someone who has channeled all of his life's energy into baseball, and so I don't know. You're supposed to say that he's, you know, putting of all of his eggs in that one basket, and then when something happens to the basket, like, I don't know, all of the eggs break or something. I'm really overextending that.
I had a hard time really reconciling De Niro's character's actions and things like that. It just didn't, and I don't know.
I think the way to enjoy this movie is to stop trying to do that. After a point, you just kind of got to give up.
Yeah, and I think it's impossible. It's definitely easier to do that after like he kidnaps the kid and stuff, and yeah, and things start to get really wild. You know, it's funny, like, I don't, there was that scene where he takes the kid to the baseball game. He takes his kid to the baseball game, and they keep cutting away to this like woman and stuff. And then like they show the woman and her husband like at their house, and it's like, it almost felt as if we were supposed to know who that lady was, the way that they kept showing her, other than just like a concerned like citizen who noticed him neglecting his son. But I don't know. That was bizarre too, how they did that and how we saw the lady there. And I don't know, man.
Release the 3-hour cut of this.
Oh, God. I mean, it already feels like just, and the whole, so much time is spent with us like going with him on sales calls and stuff. Like, I'm sorry, I don't like, if you want to make a movie about Robert De Niro being a failed knife salesman, then make that movie. But I'm watching The Fan because he's supposed to be an obsessive fan, and it's fine that he can be like a knife salesman, but they just spend so much time on the knives, the knife selling, and him like not meeting his sales quotas, and he's going to lose his job, and people are scared of him, and he's like shaving his legs and stuff for demonstrations. I don't know. I still found it entertaining. I enjoyed revisiting it after all these years, but I think that it is just not one of Tony Scott's best.
No, but he definitely makes it a lot more interesting than a lot of other directors would have been able to.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'd say if you're going through Scott's filmography, then you should still check it out. I mean, like I said, the De Niro and Snipes performances are great. And there's still some really solid scenes in it. It just, and I do like when it goes completely off the rails at the end, but it just takes a while to get there. And it's, I think, just a little bit messy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is weird. It, like you said, it does go completely off the rails at the end, but then the actual ending is like, it just builds up so much that I think maybe the reason that you didn't remember the ending is just because it promised so much and it can't deliver at the very end.
That's true. I was expecting it to be a much more grandiose ending, I think. Even though, like, as far as, like, if we're looking at this as, like, this sort of realistic look at fandom or criticism of fandom and, like, how, you know, obsessive fans can become dangerous and stuff like that, like, this is a pretty grandiose ending of what happens. But in the context of, like, how wild this movie gets, like, I was expecting it to be, like, he comes in on a helicopter and, like, falls into the helicopter blades, and that's how he dies. I don't know what.
For all the movie's build-up ends, but the only way it could have delivered and built on top of it is if, like, the finale took place in outer space.
the stadium exploded with him in it. The entire stadium exploded. Yeah. All right. That is the fan. I would still give it a light recommend, even though it's. I recognize that it's not a very good movie, but there is some nostalgia I have with it. So.
Yeah, I'd say watch it, and not only watch it, but choose like. So this is the second time I'm watching this, and the first time I saw it was a couple of years ago, a year or two ago, at. I'm not kidding. Like Christmas. Ish, like the couple days before Christmas. So I was just watching it in a living room, and just like in like that late kind of like couple days before Christmas days when you've got stuff to do later, you've got people to see.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think 2018 or 2019, I think. And so I'm just sitting there, like it is like we talk about, you know, people talk about Christmas movies. People talk about movies that have Christmas movie energy. This is like the least Christmassy Christmas movie ever. Like there's just no Christmas energy to it at all if we're quantifying it. So it was just so funny to just like sit there and watch like this entire display go past me and like looking up just right above my laptop screen, there's like a, you know, a Christmas tree and just like a gentle late December afternoon turning into nine. I'm thinking, oh, I've got to go to a Christmas party later after I finish watching Tony Scott's The Fan. And in hindsight, I think that was the perfect time to watch this for the first time.
Yeah, I think so. All right, closing things out this month is a story that explores not only one man's relationship with the game of baseball, but also that of the woman he loves. Directed by Sam Raimi and released on September 17th, 1999, this is For Love of the Game.
Critics are cheering For Love of the Game. Among the great sports films of all time is also a tender and touching romance.
How do you like to be kissed?
Not to be missed. Four stars, a great baseball film, a glorious love story.
Haven't you ever loved anything that much?
The most inspiring film of the year.
You get me back, I'll figure out how to win.
Kevin Costner, For Love of the Game. Rated PG-13, starts Friday at theaters everywhere.
Which of those pull quotes were from Peter Travers?
I would bet at least three of them.
I know there are other people who do that kind of thing besides Peter Travers, but I think
it's
he's
mostly
kind of
Travers.
Our go-to, especially for this era.
Oh yeah, it's mostly Travers.
Yeah. I did like that, like your scoff after what, like one of the greatest sports movies ever made, or whatever that one was.
Give me a break.
Anyway, after 19 years of playing the game he's loved his whole life, Detroit Tigers pitcher Billy Chappell has to decide if he's going to risk everything and put everything out there. Good grief, these IMDb synopses.
Nice. Risk everything and put everything out there.
Again, like we see, I suspect that was written quite hastily by someone in September 1999, coming back from seeing For Love of the Game, trying to desperately remember anything in it as it rapidly fades from their mind, and just typing that out, and it's just sat there for the next 22 years.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So, Adam, what did you think of ostensibly Sam Raimi's film For Love of the Game?
Yeah, what about this makes it a Sam Raimi film? I mean, out of all of the directors that you would imagine directed this film, I'm pretty sure Sam Raimi would be like one of the very last people you guess. Like it is so not a Sam Raimi film at all. Like, I'm not even, like, I don't know what the backstory is with this, but I'm sure that there's something that brought him to this, but I don't know what it is, but hopefully it never happens again, because this movie, it does some things that I like, but it does a lot of things that I don't like, and overall, it is an absolute slog to get through.
I was gonna say, as someone who and I do realize I accidentally made a pun when I say pitch this episode to you, I want to apologize for making us watch this 5.5 hour long movie.
It's like an epic. It almost feels like it goes through this guy's whole career, which is funny because like it goes through like 4 years, I think, roughly 4 years of his career.
Yeah,
and
like, yeah, the end of his the ending portion of his career, and it kind of just.
So here's but what even... this is what I like about it, because I think that I'm going to say a lot of things I don't like, but what I do like is the idea of this famous pitcher. He's 40 years old. It's perhaps his last game, and he's perhaps going to pitch a perfect game. And while he's on the mound, which, you know, they say is like the loneliest place on the field, he's sort of reminiscing and thinking about the last few years of his life, his career, like he's reliving moments from his career, and mostly he's reliving and thinking about moments that he had in this relationship with this woman named Jane, played by Kelly Preston. All of the baseball stuff and just the idea, that idea of someone who knows that this is likely going to be it for them. They're making their final bow, and they're just up there pitching and thinking about all of the experiences that they had, the times, the turmoil, the triumphs, all of that stuff. And it's all kind of like washing over him as he's throwing out each pitch. I think that's a great idea. Like, I think that is a fantastic idea for a sports film. But the thing that holds this movie back is the love story, which is absolutely awful, I think. I hated the love story. And that's like half the movie is the love story. So you have a good idea here, but it's just completely held back by this love story that is dull. It's we've seen it before. It's a relationship between two people that probably just shouldn't even exist to begin with. Like, they probably shouldn't be together. So it's like, it's not like I'm really rooting for them, because I don't think that they're necessarily, you know, good for each other or anything. Like, he's good with her kid, which is great, but, you know, he's kind of a dick. So, I, you know, like, I don't think that they should necessarily be in a relationship, but, and also, like, there's just so many aspects of it that I feel like just didn't work. And that's ultimately what is held back for me in this movie. It's just, I found the love story to be like just boring, and I couldn't get into it.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt forced. And I think that has a lot to do with Kevin Costner. I don't think Kevin Costner is a good actor, and I just don't think that he was really selling it for me. Like, I didn't believe that this character was in love with this woman. Like, I just didn't believe it. And I also felt like she fell for him like way too quickly. And it seemed like this whole whirlwind romance just happened all too fast. But also because the story was told in a sort of a nonlinear way, it made it feel even more disjointed, where like I just couldn't connect with this relationship.
Yeah, it's just a movie that completely fails to make you believe in any of the things that it ostensibly believes. There's just something so distancing about it. Like, it feels like no characters in this movie ever actually have a conversation of any substance.
That's true.
Like, they're just kind of saying words at each other, waiting for another scene.
There is a great scene where it just shows Kevin Costner dumping slices of bread into a glass of milk and eating it, or drinking it, whatever you want to call that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what that's all about. Is that a normal thing that people do?
No.
I didn't think so. Like, when I was watching, I was like, that's really gross. Like, why is he doing that?
Like, there's milk toast when you kind of make, like a roux, kind of, like, maybe, like, pour it over, like, you know, slices of bread if you, like, can't digest at the moment, but, or not a roux, maybe something quite lighter than that, but... Like, I don't know. I've never seen just anyone just, like, just put a bunch of bread and milk in a glass and just go to town.
Yeah, it was like a weird thing to include. I wanted more exploration into the bread milk. The bread milk thing.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Shaggy song that played during this, so that was very 90s, late 90s, Shaggy.
Yeah.
I like how he did the whole, like, thing where he was, like, on the plate, and he would, like, what did he say? He said, he had, like, a phrase that he would say, and it would basically, like, tune out all of the noise. Clear the mechanism is what he said. So when he would do that, it would, like, he would tune out all of the fans and the chanting and everything else, and he would just, like, purely focus. And I liked that. I liked how they represented that.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, there is some good to how those scenes are shot.
And there was some humor in here, too, which I liked, but it was just so fleeting.
Mm,
I could have used some more humor.
Mm-hmm.
Especially from, like, John C. Reilly.
Yeah. A lot of people in this movie who don't really do anything.
Yeah.
Sometimes including the stars in the movie.
I do remember, there was one line that I remember where he was on the plate and he was pitching it. So he was playing, they're playing the Yankees, and he was pitching against a player who used to be on his team, on the Tigers. And he goes, "I'll miss you the most, Scarecrow." And I'm just like, come on, man. Can you, come on.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have to, like, some of the dialogue in this movie is so goofy, like, just laughably goofy. "I'll miss you the most, Scarecrow." Like, what makes him the Scarecrow? Like, he seemed like a pretty compassionate dude from the beginning. Like, Scarecrow was the one who needed the heart, right? So, or no, he needed the brain, didn't he? Yeah, he needed the brain. Well, still,
yeah.
My original comment still stands. He didn't seem like a dum-dum.
Yeah, I knew what you meant. I also want to add an additional factor that might actually explain a lot of our concerns here. Specifically with the director. Somebody had Final Cut privilege on this movie. Do you know who it was?
No.
It wasn't Sam Raimi. you have a second guess?
Kevin Costner?
Kevin Costner had Final Cut on this movie.
I knew it.
And suddenly it seems to make a lot more sense.
Yeah. All of a sudden, all of the pieces have fallen into place.
There's like this, I don't have time to get into this now, but I found this like really long, like LA Times piece from 1999 about all of the problems the movie had. There's apparently also a struggle with the MPAA where it got an R rating for, I think language, but I couldn't figure out exactly why at first when I was just skimming through this information in this article, because I first started on like the Wikipedia page. And I'm just, you know, skimming and talking at the same time, and I'm just like coming across it, and I'm seeing that it says a handful of lines amounting to roughly 10 seconds of film, and I just see 10 seconds of film being the difference between a PG-13 and an R, and the first place my mind went was that scene with the milk and the bread a lot longer? And like the MPAA was just like just absolutely horrified by whatever happened.
It was actually a 30-second scene, and he was just going to town on that bread milk, and he was just saying all of these like profanities, like, oh my god, like he was just loving it so much. He was laying out all kinds of profanities as he was gorging himself on the milk bread.
I just assumed that the sheer bizarre sight of someone making those choices
it just horrified them.
It just horrified the MPA, and they're like, "You have to cut this. We can't just show this to people."
It was originally like shot in like extreme close up, and Kevin Costner was just chewing with his mouth open the whole time. Yeah, there's probably like more than one F bomb in it, and that's probably what.
Yeah, that's what it was.
That's probably what they freaked out about.
Another piece from this LA Times article is that another fight was over the runtime. Costner's final cut came with a condition that has to be PG-13, and that should be under 130 minutes, which this is definitely not under 130 minutes. And that was one of the compromises the studio ended up making, was that they let the de facto director for Love of the Game, Kevin Costner, put this out at 137 minutes.
God.
In exchange for the cuts that made it PG-13.
I wonder how Sam Raimi. I wonder if he even cared. Like, did it bother him? Like, it must have bothered him.
Somebody else was directing this movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird too because this is after The Postman. Is it the one directly after The Postman? Let's see. Message in a Bottle came out the same year, and Play It to the Bone. Oh, Play It to the Bone. He was just a Ringside fan.
I mean, just on a financial level, if someone was, you know, coming out of that, and then they give him like a $50 million 2-hour and 20-minute baseball movie, and they're like, "You have Final Cut privilege on this."
I don't get it, man.
Over the director.
Like, is it all Dances with Wolves? It has to be, right? Or maybe, yeah. Field of Dreams? Like what? Like what?
I mean, yeah, that's kind of the thing. It's like it's somehow like the bookend of that, but.
I think it's got to be Dances with Wolves just because he directed that too. Mm-hmm. And that was like such a huge movie that thing was 3 hours long too. Dear God. Mm-hmm. Just a quick FYI. I don't plan on ever watching Dances with Wolves for this show. I don't think I'd be able to endure it. Mm-hmm. Although it might be funny to like, do that to like sort of torture ourselves, like do all of those like super long period pieces that came out in the 90s, like Dances with Wolves, Last of the Mohicans, was the English Patient, that was like super long, wasn't it?
Pretty long, isn't it?
Yeah, 2 hours and 42 minutes, The English Patient. Oh my god, what a brutal month that would be.
That's if we ever have to like create like a hard series finale for Saved by the 90s, it's that.
It's gonna be all 90s movies that were like
3 hours long.
3 hours or longer. Oh man.
That's the final episode of this podcast. It's like how there's that thing that Ted Turner, I think, created this when he launched CNN. He had this clip commissioned of a marching band playing "Nearer My God to Thee," and he said that CNN was going to broadcast till the end of the world, and so they'd have something to show when the world was ending. And so it's in the database under the instruction "Hold for release until end of the world is confirmed." Just a band playing "Nearer My God to Thee." What we do is we actually sometime we do that maybe over a series of a long time, like just a series of months, so we don't have to do it all at once. We do that, like just 4-5 movies that are all 3 hours long. We record that podcast, and much like that CNN clip, we only release it as the world is ending.
Put it in the vault until then.
Yes. That's a podcast that only releases when end of the world is confirmed.
That's an idea. There we go. Then you can hear our thoughts, our extended thoughts on the English Patient.
Yeah, as the asteroid is coming towards us, you can hear us talk about the English Patient and Dances with Wolves.
Oh, man. The Postman is 2 hours and 57 minutes.
We'll add it in.
Oh, my God. I actually don't think I ever saw The Postman, to be honest with you. Because when it came out, it was like, it was so maligned that I was like, oh, well, definitely not going to see that. And honestly, I was never a big fan of, like, I just don't get Kevin Costner. Like, I don't understand how he's a thing. Like, I'm sure he's a cool dude in real life or whatever, but I just don't think he's a very good actor at all. Like, in this movie, in any movie, like if you see like Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, like, talk about movies that don't hold up. That movie's like complete garbage if you watch it now. But it was huge back then.
I think I'm kind of realizing, kind of as an extension of that, that I really don't have strong opinions on Kevin Costner. Like, just, you know, he's by the bad. Time I become like aware of him, by the time I'm born,
he's not a he's good actor. So
he's just so settled into like the cultural, you know, canon. I'm like, okay, here's a guy that's always there.
He's so low energy. He's just like the most low energy actor ever. No emotion. I don't know. Anyway, that's enough of me going on about Kevin Costner.
I think he's been fine in things. Yeah, he was also in Bull Durham. That's a third baseball movie.
Yeah, yeah. He's a big, you know, big baseball fan.
Yeah.
I don't think I liked him in anything that I've ever seen him in. Maybe JFK. Maybe JFK. I do seem to remember liking him in Mr. Brooks, where he played the serial killer. But I remember not liking the movie, but I did like his role in it. Mm-hmm. I think that's like it. I think that's pretty much... Like, I don't think I liked anything else he was in.
I just think you probably generally have stronger Costner takes than I do at this point in my life.
Yeah, maybe.
He's there for me. He's not there. He's not there. Happens.
Yep. All right. Anything else that you want to add about For Love of the Game? I think that it is way too long. I don't really think it's worth a look. If you're a fan of Sam Raimi, you can probably still skip it because this does not feel like a Sam Raimi movie at all.
Kevin Costner movie.
Yeah, it's most definitely a Kevin Costner movie. He one thing I will say about him is that he is a commanding presence in anything that he's in, that's for sure. Apparently in front of and behind the camera. Anything else, Dad?
I'm not on this movie. I'm just glad, you know, sometimes it's hard for us to try to figure out exactly what we're going to do in a given month, but I'm glad we confirmed our show to be released when the world ends.
We got that one locked in. We don't know what we're doing for next month yet, but we got that one locked in.
While the, you know, whatever it's going to be, while the meteor is coming towards us or you're huddled in the basement that they tell you to go to, that's definitely not going to protect you from the nuclear bombs that are going to start dropping all around, you can rest assured that in our final moments on this earth, as Nearer My God to Thee plays on CNN, you can hear our takes on all of the 3.5 hour 1990s movies that are primarily now known only for their length.
I bet we can add Waterworld to that list, too. I remember Waterworld was really long, too. 2 hours and 15 minutes. Okay, well, I don't think that quite makes the cut. All right, I think that's going to do it for this month. Thank you so much for listening. You can send us your questions and comments at 90s@filmpulse.net or by sending us a DM on Twitter or Facebook at 90spod. Until next month, for Ken Bakley, my name's Adam Patterson, and this has been Saved by the 90s.
Bye, everyone.